such larger participation in the cosmos as he may require is automatically provided for by nature itself, that he shall therefore receive his proper allotment of energy from the sun, or receive what he needs from the various cosmic energies in space. This allotment is his inevitably. But for the rest, he is supposed to function within a certain range. And within this certain range, he has about all he can achieve. And ancient peoples recognized, therefore, that man already lives in two kinds of worlds, but that instead of these worlds being the physical universe as he sees it and the invisible universe around it, these worlds are actually the visible universe as he sees it and the invisible regions within himself. The unknown world which must constantly concern the human being is his own inner life. And his own inner life is the symbol which he has attempted to justify by casting his reflection upon space. Space, the outside, the invisible universe around us, is merely a symbol for the unknown within us. And theoretically, in order to solve any region of the outside mystery, we must solve the corresponding region of the inside mystery. So the human being has the same problem almost as the first remarks we made about the planet. As the planet consists of dry land and water, and the creatures of the sea are more numerous than those of the land, so man is also, even physically and psychophysically, two beings, a land body or land creature, composed of his external faculties and perceptions, and a creature of deep oceans, these oceans being the subconscious within himself. This subconscious is strangely populated. The inner life of the individual is far more mysterious than his outer. It is also more complex and more meaningful. But because we have lived in the objective side of our nature, almost since the dawn of our creation, and because also the faculties that we know are all more or less pointed outward to give us contact with environment but not with self, we have labored under the continuous disadvantage that we lack the organized, obvious means of exploring the one region which is the challenge we all must face. Everything, therefore, that we reflect upon the unknown around us is due to the distortions of the unknown within us. And this unknown within us has given rise to all the fears, all the doubts, all the uncertainties, all the griefs and grievances with which we have attempted to mutilate the outer universe. Every problem that we fear on the outside exists only on the inside. This means that the individual from within himself is constantly releasing orders of mysterious beings. These mysterious beings are benevolent or evil creatures, according to the qualities of our own thought emotional patterns that bring them into existence. But all of them become the mysterious inhabitants of sleep, the mysterious monsters of dreams and nightmares and visions. So the person attempting to solve the mystery of himself by reference to the outside space is trying to continue to use the faculties with which he examines environment in the belief that if he can go far enough into the invisible around him, he will find cause. This he cannot do any more than he can find the cause of life by building a spaceship that could take him to the furthest star in our galaxy. He might learn in that way to understand that star, but the secret of life and of reality will be as far from him as it is today. because he cannot travel outwardly to discover that which can be experienced only inwardly. Truth can be discovered only by experience. A man can experience nothing but himself. He can contemplate all kinds of things, but the vital experience of I know can only come from the internal life of the person. So in the next consideration that we have, we have to think about man. Now, what kind of a creature is man? Man is visible and invisible. This we realize. His visible parts bind him to the known world. His invisible parts seem to unite him to the unknown world. And yet man is not part, really, of another kind of world, because what we call the unknown in this case is only that which transcends sensory perception. We have many references and accounts of the inner construction of man himself in relationship to the universe. Almost all of these accounts finally agree that man himself is a kind of miniature world, and that just as surely as the solar system was believed theologically to consist of heaven, earth, and hell, so man is likewise a triad, consisting of a divine nature, a human nature, and a strange, shadowy sub-nature, which was his inferno, and which has always tormented him and always will. And it is this inferno which he must some way cope with. And in the ancient writings, we are told, for instance, that Jesus, after the crucifixion, descended into limbo and redeemed the souls of the lost. In other words, he descended into the infernal region. In Buddhism, the same concept is described, in which the Buddha is said to have multiplied his nature so that he appeared simultaneously in all of the 49 realms of Avicii, or the underworld, and there redeemed the souls of the dead. And the presence which he left behind when he left these regions was the lotus, which to all these became the symbol of eternal hope. But this Avicii problem, this whole problem of the under region, means that the individual, in order to attain freedom, particularly from the cycle of transmigratory existence, has to redeem his own underworld. Now, in attempting to redeem his own underworld, he is in exactly the same problem as the medieval, who saw this underworld around him, lapping upon the very steps of the cathedral. He was only able to hide in sanctuary or tuck himself under the edge of some bishop's robe to avoid perdition before the day was out. This world of evil closing in upon medieval man, bringing with it the Inquisition, the witchcraft problems, the cycles of demonology which caused thousands of innocent persons to die, this whole situation finally traces itself back to the sub-regions of man's own nature. For there is in every individual this region of negation, this region into which is constantly flowing the endless mistakes of living, this region which is kept alive by the errors of life, this region in which everything that is negative, everything that is destructive, everything that is selfish, continues on to create psychic vortices. Vortices which the ancients like to think of as demons. Various elementaries of negative and horrible proportions. But man was creating, out of his own negation, a hierarch of infernal monsters. These are the ones which he gives a certain life to by vitalizing them with his own thoughts, with his own intensities, with his own emotions, sustaining them by his own self-willfulness, by the bitterness of his attitudes, by his criticism and condemnation. These things are constantly building evil. Now, back in the Paracelsian days, it was assumed that if we kept doing this long enough, if we kept building this corruption into our own subconscious, it would become very much like a corrupted land. It would be a place in which plagues might well arise. Many of the ancient peoples believed that what we call germs and bacteria and things of this nature are really manifestations of this psychic evil that lurks within things. That the destructive forces of life, which take form in lower kingdoms, are in reality the embodiments of the negative psychic pressures of living things. That they are the devourers, the destroyers, the corruptors of flesh. And that therefore the individual may interpret this in two ways. Either that perhaps sickness, physical sickness, is caused by this gradual increasing pressure of negation in the subjective part of self. Or else that this negation becomes a swarm of semi-living elementary creatures. And that these creatures, like strange fungus, or like mysterious creatures, parasites, can take hold of and drain the body of its resources and the mind and heart of their values and energies. In any event, the ancients held it to be self-evident that man carries within himself this region of his own undoing, and that his first and real purpose is to solve this. That this is his own underworld, the mysterious eighth sphere of the Gnosis. This world, which has really no existence, but is continually forced into the seemingness of existence by the seemingness of evil in the deeds and thoughts and emotions of living things. Thus, in the Persian philosophy, we have the war between light and darkness. But light is ultimately victorious. And in the struggle between all good and all evil in the nature of things, truth is ultimately victorious. For it is truth and truth alone that can set us free. And truth in this case represents always the disciplines of a doctrine of integrity by means of which we drain this swamp of its corruptions. So in the older philosophies and so on, it was assumed that whatever evil man saw around him was but the shadow of the unconquered negation within him, that he was forever projecting this negation out into space, that this negation by projection invested itself with countless forms, some of which come back upon man in hideous proportion, such as war, crime waves, great pestilences, and outbreaks of nature. And nearly every war in history has been followed by a plague, because in many ways, wars set up these terrible hatreds, which in the invisible atmospheres of our lives corrupt the flesh and cause us to sicken from within. When great numbers sicken from within, we see the proportions of an epidemical ailment. So the ancients began their thought of life by recommending a twofold attitude. Man instinctively desiring to see the world around him and to solve its mystery, and also desiring to see a better world within himself and solve its mystery, may function in both regions, using each to symbolize the other, and both to attain the common good. It becomes a basic matter of placing his own attitudes under certain basic supervision. Without this supervision, he cannot achieve his end. In the Oriental problem phase of this, we see the gradual development of certain gentle arts, which increase man's appreciation for the mysteries of universal life. In other words, as man begins to see the universe around him as a thing of beauty, he begins also to experience a change within him. It has been demonstrated that to the degree our own lives become harmless, the world appears harmless, and the psychic life becomes harmless within us. We have to constantly sustain these illusions by supporting them with each other. Therefore, if we begin to see nature as lawful and kind, we begin to gain a strength to penetrate the illusion within ourselves. This is the reason why I think the law of causality is so very, very important. Because if we believe, as the Buddhist believes, that there is an infinite justice, and that this justice is never wrong, that this justice is law, and this law is innate and inevitable. If we believe this, we slowly dispose of most of the demons with which the universe around us seems to be infested. And in Buddhism, this happened in a very interesting way, because the old Buddhist priests going into foreign regions, finding all kinds of demons that were held in high revere, promptly converted the demons first. And after that, the people became happy and the demons became good and faithful servants of the true doctrine. Now, I don't remember very many instances in Western thinking where folks went out determined to convert the fallen angel. They didn't seem to start it that way. They wanted to defend themselves against evil. They didn't realize that it is perfectly possible to transform evil, that it is perfectly possible for evil to cease, simply through the inner understanding of the meaning of law and of lawfulness and of order and of the proprieties of things. In the same way, if we gradually come to the conviction that we live in an honest universe, it becomes almost inevitable that we must take the same attitude toward our own internal lives. The discovery of universal honesty presumes the presence of an inner honesty in ourselves. The moment we begin to be able to take the storms and the rains and the winds of the world around us and see that they are part of a divine plan, we also begin to organize the tempests within our own little teapot. Things change their appearances. We begin to get rid of the grudges. We begin to get rid of the antagonisms and the criticisms that can never do anything but hurt. And because we outgrow them, these dark areas within our own nature relax. And little by little, we do, it would seem, redeem one by one the lost spirits in our own purgatories. For these lost spirits are really phases of ourselves. They are the lost attitudes, the useless and meaningless sorrows with which we break up our own personalities into a whole race of suffering fragments, each afflicted with some attitude that is destructive to its common good. Thus, in a way, we put together the elements of the two worlds. We find out then why it wasn't necessary for us to depend upon a knowledge of infinite space in order to put our own house in order. It is the growing up and the maturing of the sense of the benevolence of things within ourselves. And this experience has to come as an experience, not as a known fact of outer living. If we were aware of every benevolence of the universe, and it could be scientifically proven, if we were certain of every law that existed, man would be denied of the greatest part of his own redemption. He would be denied of the right and the power to make the personal statement of good in the presence of shadows. He would lose the entire privilege, the magnificent opportunity of discovering that which he must discover, and which he can discover only by his own effort. If it was all revealed to him, there would never be those hours in which he had to claim his own heritage of faith. There would never be those long nights in which he had to struggle with the weaknesses and infirmities of his own flesh. And yet without victories over these negations, voluntary victories, gained not because the truth was evident, but because the principle of right could be dimly perceived and must be obeyed. The individual then grows, not by what is handed to him, but by what he achieves out of the smallness of his own insight. Knowing a little, he must make a good decision. By this, he grows. But if he knew all, there would be no need for decision. And somewhere in this structure of man, the pattern says that he must grow through the gradual process of affirming the realities and having the courage to live by principles which he cannot prove, but which in his consciousness he knows to be true. This is the real challenge, that having projected a certain conviction, as Wallace cast the heart of Bruce into the battle, so man must follow this conviction and fulfill it. He must, with the small courage of partial insight, meet the challenge of his own spiritual need. He does not accomplish this, in some way his own growth is frustrated. To make this challenge inevitable, two things have to be present in nature. And the universe, visible or invisible, must keep these rules. One thing is, there cannot be anything out there in the unknown of space that can prevent man from achieving his own destiny. There can't be something out there with a hammer that can knock him down for no reason. There cannot be a vengeful spirit or an evil sprite that can in any way stand between the individual and that which is his proper destiny. Thus, the invisible world around him cannot make him or break him. Whatever its contribution is, he will know in due time. But there is nothing out there that can take from his stature or add to it. If there was one thing utterly unknown to him and utterly beyond his control, which was inimical to his destiny, man would be completely frustrated. If there was a power greater than he is that was able to frustrate his achievement for reasons that are arbitrary or purposeless, or by whim, or by some temper of a deity, then the entire concept of cause and effect falls apart. So whatever there is that is there cannot be an interfering thing, nor can it be a solving thing. For if there is anything there that can solve man's problem without man earning solution, then he would be perfectly justified in assuming that he could elect a government that would represent him here, which he has never yet been able to do, and never will. If it was possible for anything else or anyone else to solve our problems, they would have been solved long ago. But the fact remains, we must solve our own. So whatever the secondary powers, be they cherubic or demoniacal, so-called, whether they be imps or angels, whatever they are, they cannot interfere with the destiny of the individual or his right to be himself. Because to do so would imply that man is then a victim of something which his own sensory perceptions and his own reflective powers cannot cope with. And man is not expected to do the impossible. All that is required from him is a reasonable effort to fulfill not only the possible, but the immediately necessary. If he will do what is next, all the rest will be forgiven him. So man must not look upon this universe of things outside of him as menacing his growth or as fulfilling some weakness in himself so that he does not have to do these things. The invisible world is not a welfare state. The invisible world is not a place where you can reap without sowing or where you plow under every other row. In the universe, this invisible world is part of a great evolving structure. It is like a field of grain on the opposite side of the earth where we cannot see it, but it is growing by the same rules as the grain on this side of the earth. Everything is lawful. And the moment we begin to realize this, we do not have to fear the unknown. And as we reach the point where we no longer fear the unknown, we do not invest it with supernatural powers. Whatever its powers may be, for itself they are natural. Whatever these powers may be, it is inevitable that in the order of our way of life, they cannot exercise a supernatural effect upon us. Or again, they would interfere. So if they affect us at all, it is within the natural boundaries of our expectancies, conscious or unconscious. Perhaps they are affecting us, perhaps they help digest our food, perhaps they regulate the liver. We do not know. But whatever those forces are, they are normal and reasonable. They are not destructive, they are not angry, they are not evil. They can do nothing to prevent us from achieving, nor can they make our achievement inevitable. So against this background, the individual must follow the admonition of the wise and work out his own salvation with diligence. He must work out his salvation perfectly certain that the universe around him will cooperate with his own labor. That as he fulfills his responsibilities and his duties, the laws working through space reward him in right measure. Therefore, that in this space that we do not see or understand, there are the workings of laws. These laws rewarding everything according to its achievements, according to its motives, according to its insight, and its dedications. And that which is itself without purpose is rewarded in that way, without purpose. So whatever we can think of a world of creatures all about the business of their own growth, which is the proper business of existence. And we can also think of this space as filled with the manifestations of those universal laws by which the dignities and securities of all lives are preserved and protected. Whatever comes out of space is honest. Whatever comes out of the invisible is the ever-working of the law. Whatever other things may exist in space, which have no relation to man at the moment, these other things fulfill their destinies, but they do not impinge upon us. If we can get this thought thoroughly set in our own minds, we will not ask space for favors, nor will we build defenses in our own minds against the strange darkness that lurks there. We will accept space just as we accept night, as the unseen part of a common world. And that in this night there are creatures that belong to the night. And in the day there are creatures that belong to the day. That the alternation of day and night is essential to the regulation of nature. So all things fulfill themselves in their proper sequences and in their proper patterns. Man has no reason to fear. And it is interesting to realize that when you travel into other parts of the world, you find the invisible universe around us comes sometimes very close in the belief and attitudes of peoples. Down in the Balkan areas, for example, there are many superstitions and beliefs which we do not share here. If you go and live in those regions long enough, you find these beliefs closing in upon you. First thing you know, the ignorance of those people begins to give you a haunted world, and you begin to see all the mysterious creatures of their peculiar folklore and legendary and demonology. If you stay there long enough, you will believe them all, and perhaps you will even see some of them. And you will hear the banshees crying in the night. And you will actually see werewolves if you're not very careful. But then you come back to your own home again in a more prosaic community. And in a few months, this all fades out. And you say to yourself, how could I ever have believed this? Therefore, we do say that in an atmosphere where we are influenced negatively, we begin to visualize and project out of our own subconscious the fulfillment of any attitude that slowly takes possession of the mind. This is the reason why it is very important to us philosophically and religiously to make sure that every attitude that does dominate our thinking is a just one, is a reasonable and lawful attitude, and that at all times we instinctively turn to the unknown and bless it and not curse it. And we can only reach this instinct where within ourselves we have ceased to curse anything, where we have gradually learned to experience the inner part of ourselves as beautiful and experience all other people as fulfilling their natural destinies and growing according to their lights and their ways. And that little by little, all hatreds, all dissonances, all discords vanish from our own consciousness. The moment this happens to the individual, he can no longer be the victim of obsessing demons or horrible dreams, nor can he be terrified by the night, nor can he look around him in the world and not knowing the thinking of other people, begin to suspect that all these people are terrible and hateful creatures. Sometimes perhaps he is wrong. Perhaps some of these people are not quite as good as he thought they were. But his own health, his own survival, his own integration demands that in his own heart he keeps seeking until he finds the good. He cannot acknowledge the evil in anything without acknowledging it in himself. So all this problem of working back and forth, of creating strange fantasies of sleep and dreams, of nightmares and all these things, result also gradually in the building up of collective patterns. And in these patterns, as we see them working in the world today, we see negative patterns gaining strength all the time from the common misunderstandings and false attitudes of people. These patterns become customary. But regardless of how many hold the pattern, how much the substances of the subconscious are contaminated, there cannot be one person contaminated who does not accept the pattern himself and permit it. No matter how prevalent the evil is, each individual must accept that evil and be infected by it through some action of his own. He cannot receive this evil because another million has it. He can only partake of this evil if he has corrupted his own integrity in some way. So there is no power in nature or in the universe that can hurt the individual who has not opened himself to being hurt by a disobedience of the natural laws of benevolence. If we keep this constantly in our thoughts, we will not be so subject to hauntings and things of that nature, and life in general will enable us to get along with those we can see and also the ones we cannot see in a reasonably pleasant manner. And this is something greatly to be desired, because sometimes our worst enemies are shadows, and some individuals suffer acutely from their inability to discover the magnificent integrity at the root of life. These are the ones, perhaps, who suffer the most. It is hard to find a friend who is false, but it is much more difficult to live in a universe that seems to be false. But fortunately, the universe can never be false except in seeming, for in substance it is always true. And the individual who is able to hold this attitude and work gradually to finding this truth will in the same time put both the universe and his adversary in their proper places. He will be free from both evils. So that from the universe we learn something of ourselves, and from ourselves we learn something of the universe. And this is apparently as far as we're supposed to go, and I think it's probably far enough to go for the first evening. So thank you very kindly.